Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, where we invite all sides to face the music and dance together through conversations for co-creation. Well, there's a famous joke supposedly told by a Soviet delegate during a meeting to discuss trade between the U.S. and the Soviet Union during the Cold War era. And the joke was, what's the difference between capitalism and communism? In capitalism, man exploits man. In communism, it's the other way around. Well, you know, the 20th century has certainly offered up plenty of evidence that, given human nature and the nature of the dominator virus that has dominated human affairs for the past 5,000 years, in spite of our best intentions, neither system has created social justice or sustainable economic well-being. That brings us to a program I'm very excited today, featuring a unique experiment, the Mondragon Cooperatives in the Basque regions of Spain. Our guest, Georgia Kelly, today writes, and I quote, "It seems that Mondragon has taken the very best ideas from both capitalism and socialism and created a hybrid that supports people as well as their ideas, health, education, personal development, and society. Whatever one calls it, it works. And it works better for more people than any other economic system today." Now, if the name Georgia Kelly sounds familiar, it's because this is the same Georgia Kelly who was a world-famous harpist in the 1980s and 1990s and who's had albums on the Billboard Top 10 in classical crossover and New Age charts. Today, she's with us as the founder of Praxis Peace Institute and someone who has been to Mondragon many times and leads tours there. She's here to tell us more about this remarkable enterprise, why and how it's been successful, and how their lessons and practices can be applied in the USA and elsewhere. So welcome, Georgia.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Thank you. So let's begin with a meta question, or several of them. Mondragon, why is it important now? Why do people need to know about it? And we can expand this in our conversation later on in a sentence or two. How and why is it applicable to our situation here in the United States?
Okay, well, first I would say you mentioned it as an experiment. I would not call Mondragon an experiment. I think it's proven itself and it's passed the experimental stage. Maybe it passed it a long time ago, but it is really a highly functioning consortium of cooperatives in the Basque region of Spain. So I would get past that right away. And how we can learn about it for here, there are cooperatives in the U.S. and especially in the Bay Area and the New York region, and there are others throughout the U.S. But I think Mondragon is the beacon because they have been around the longest. They began in the mid-50s. They were founded by a Catholic priest. And I think this is an interesting part, and maybe it's part of the reason the values that hold it together are so strong. It's not in any way religious, but it does have a strong ethical base. And that is always something that the people who are part of Mondragon as worker owners are very well aware of. And they, in a sense, buy into that ethical value system, which is one of the things I think that keeps it working so well and has made it grow at a realistic pace, not at a breakneck pace that is worried about constantly developing new markets. I think their focus, as they say, has always been on they put people before profit. So it's to create jobs for people, not to make profit for themselves. So it's, there's an ethic underlying the entire group of worker-owned businesses. And today they have about 105, I think. It fluctuates because new ones come online. And so I think in terms of trying to look at how does that work, how would it work here, I think they're far ahead of us in the sense that they have developed a corporation that oversees over 100 worker-owned businesses, from small businesses to large businesses. And here we usually have one worker-owned business or maybe a few of them that congregate together. So we have a lot to learn about how they've set up this very large, how do I put this? It's a corporation that is over, it's like an umbrella over all the worker-owned businesses within its within the cooperative grouping. So I'm not sure where I've gone with your question. There's so many things to say about this remarkable place.
How many people are actually employed there? And I guess that many of these people are vested as owners.
Yes, almost all of them are. The only ones that wouldn't be would be the ones that come on for their 18-month trial period, where you know, they look to see if it's going to work for them and if it's going to work for the person who's applying for the job. So there's a trial period, and then they pay in, I think it's 15,000 euros to become a member, and that money is actually loaned to them, assuming that they don't have it coming in, by the Mondragon Bank, the Lavra Pucha. And I think it's 1% interest for 10 years, so it's extremely reasonable. And so that period of time, those people aren't considered for worker owners yet. But all the rest of them are in the Basque region and in much of Spain. So they're probably close to 80,000 worker owners at this point.
Wow. Wow. You know, one thing that you said that really, that's a lot of people, that struck me is the strong ethical base and the idea of, you know, putting people first, et cetera, et cetera. And here, we can talk more about this as the conversation unfolds. Here we have a situation where, you know, the god of market economics, Milton Friedman, declared that the only purpose of a business is to make is the bottom line, the financial bottom line. And so it might be, and we can certainly discuss this, something about that culture that we can learn from related to the cooperativeness of the that was there already.
Well, they will say that, and they have in several of the seminars that I've sat through. I've led eight groups already to the Mondragon Cooperatives for a week-long seminar, and we have our ninth one this May. People can sign up for it if they're interested, which is it's actually quite a profound learning experience to be there for a week and to have them as teachers and to visit some of their workplaces. But their goal is to create jobs, and they will say that up front. They say that in every seminar I've sat through. It's not to create profit, it's to create jobs. And I think where that comes from is in the 1950s, the 1940s and 50s, when Arizmendi came to that region as a parish priest, it was the poorest area of Spain. I mean, it was highly impoverished, 60% or more unemployed, lots of unemployed men, young men. And they didn't see any prospects for the future. And what this priest was able to do was bring people together, start a polytechnic school to educate them so they could get jobs in some of the industrial firms in Bilbao, Spain. But what they ended up doing, they did get those jobs, but then five of them began their own company making kerosene stoves. So that was the beginning in 1955 with one little business, five people, and the goal was to create employment for the people in this very impoverished region. Now, what's interesting is in the 50s, it was the poorest area of Spain. Today, it is the wealthiest area of Spain, even outshining Barcelona and the Catalonian area. So
isn't
it's made an incredible advance And it's all through, or primarily through, worker-owned businesses that this has happened.
Isn't that interesting that it went from an area where people are looking for jobs, you know, to work at other places, and so this initial business of five people, that was they all owned it cooperatively. Is that how the whole thing got started?
That's how the whole thing got started. Of course, the visionary was this priest, Father Arizmendi Arrieta. He was the visionary who saw the possibilities and helped create the whole thing. He helped get the bank started, which really was the major driver of more businesses being created. And I think, you know, his vision, he was able to impart the vision in a very kind of colloquial, social way with people, and it got across. And I think that was quite amazing. In fact, one of those five men who started that original co-op is still alive, and we saw him. He goes to Mass every day in Mondragon in the church, and so we saw him coming out one day. He was pointed out to us, and I think the other four are no longer alive, but one is in his 90s and still quite active, I guess, in his own way.
So what's really interesting, I'm sorry, go ahead. You were going to say one more thing, and I
want to interject. Well, no, I was just saying to go back to how they started and what's happened. And, you know, when I say they're the wealthiest area, I think Americans might get the wrong impression. And this is a very important point. I mean, people who come on our trips always notice that, oh, there doesn't seem to be any poverty here. There aren't any slums, and there are no homeless people. And this is quite incredible. All the roads look like they were paved yesterday. There are no potholes. Everything is in such good shape and good repair. And so they notice that there's, you know, lack of poverty. But what they tend to not notice, because, you know, it's not in our culture to notice this, is there's also no obvious great wealth. So that's the other end of the spectrum. They've kind of cut off the ends of the spectrum so that everybody lives well. And this is the part that would be the hard sell in America, I think. Mm-hmm. But that's what it takes to develop this. You know, everyone isn't getting the same salary. Everyone isn't, you know, in the same level. But they've lopped off these ends that seem to depend on each other to exist and have created a comfortable place for really everybody. And that's commendable, and I think it's something we can really learn from.
And it was done voluntarily without any kind of coercion. It wasn't done by the coercion of a state. I mean, it was done basically as you said earlier, a hybrid, where it's a worker-owned system that has to compete in the capitalist marketplace.
Today it does. And they will say that their system is not for everyone. They totally realize that. No, of course, there was no coercion. But it's not for everybody. There's some people who just feel like they have to do their own thing, and that's fine. But they exist for people who really prefer working in this kind of environment. I know every time we go, practically, there'll be one of our participants who will ask one was a former CEO of their bank, and one of our participants asked, well, why did you stay at the Mondragon Bank when you could make so much more money in a regular bank in Spain? Because the pay ratio in the Mondragon cooperatives is normally 1-6. They've made a few exceptions, 1-8, but usually it's 1-6. The lowest paid to the highest paid, it's only 6 times more. So that's a ratio that, you know, creates a lot of equity, a lot of equality in the whole system. But when he was asked this question, he said, well, it's not about money. It's about community. It's about being with the people I want to be with, working in an environment I feel comfortable with. It had nothing to do with money. The decision wasn't related to money. And probably, you know, because they have a much better social system, both in the country of Spain and in the Mondragon cooperatives, they have their own social system as well. There's more security there. They don't have to be worried in the same way that Americans might have to be.
That's a big issue here. And, you know, we take it for granted that there is nobody going to support us, that there isn't really a safety net. And just because of these kinds of values, it harkens back to the origin of the word health And the origin of the word wealth is the same. The word wealth comes from the same root as the word health. So in a certain regard, if you're talking about that being a quote-unquote wealthy region, it's a wealthy region because it's a healthy region, because people aren't as they're not as concerned about their my God, if I lose my job, or if I'm disabled, or if there's an unexpected expense, all of a sudden I'm put into this horrific situation. And these people prefer living this way. And who knows, maybe with our economic conditions these days, more and more people would go, you know, I'd rather have that than have the big house or all of these other things. One more thing about this is that here's a hybrid, something that might have looked like socialism, and yet here it is emerging during the Francisco Franco regime, which is noted as a right-wing regime. How did they stay under the radar in that regard?
Well, I can see we're going to have a break soon, so I'll just start, but then we can take it up afterwards.
Yeah, good.
I think this is an interesting thing that really affected the way they grew the cooperative businesses. They've been very much under the radar. They worked under the radar during the Franco regime, and they got so used to it that they're still like that. There's kind of an under-the-radar way of doing business. They don't promote themselves. They don't advertise what they do. They're just not into that at all. So I think part of that was the culture that they came out of, but also part of it was what they had to do during Franco's regime.
Oh, it's going to be a very interesting conversation. We talk a little bit about how this experiment that's no longer an experiment developed and so on. And then after the break, we'll talk with you, George, a little bit about your own history and how you came to the work that you're doing now. We'll take a little break, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Imagine, it is the year 2039. A single corporation controls most of the world through genetic modification, food, and drugs. A senior geneticist's lover dies, launching him on a quest to take down the psychopathic CEO and the handful of elite families that control the corporation. The feature film Corporate Prey, based on the novel of the same name, points us toward a dystopian future where we seem to be headed. Huge corporations do largely control our farms and our pharma. And wealthy elites seem to be operating to the detriment of most humans. Can we reverse course? Can prophecy lead to prevention? Can a movie awaken enough of us in time? To find out more and how you can help bring this enlightening film to light, go to CorporatePrey.com. Corporate Prey. That's P-R-E-Y.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket. A tent, a sandbag, a doctor. Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
In the wake of a hurricane, your monetary donation can make a huge difference to those in need. To donate, visit supporthurricanerelief.org. That's supporthurricanerelief.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Steve Behrman here. I'm back with my guest, Georgia Kelly. We're talking about the Mondragon Cooperatives. We're going to be talking a little bit about how it developed in a very unique environment. But before we do that, I want to find out more. I'm always interested in how people find their calling or how they find serial callings. And so your first career, Georgia, was as a musician. I knew you before I knew you. I knew you through your music. I've had your back when there were LPs, you're not 78s, by the way, LPs, just LPs.
Right.
And so I'm just curious as to how that evolved into your founding the Praxis Peace Institute.
Well, there are many, many reasons why that ended up happening. And I think one is I've always had sort of a political bent and certainly interested in what's happening in society, how we can improve our world. And that's always been an interest of mine. When I was doing music, I was also running my own record label, so I didn't have a lot of time to pursue those things then, but I did get together with people and talk about them, and even in the throes of my music career, I also worked on Jerry Brown's presidential campaign back in 1992 and was a delegate, and kind of got back into everything at that point. And around that same time, I had discovered I had relatives in what is now the former Yugoslavia, Croatia. And I ended up going there and living there for 6 months in 1991, the year the Civil War happened and the whole country fell apart. It was a very interesting time to be there, sometimes a little scary, but mostly what I got from that was how we can't avoid war without some very real structural change in society. And so that became very interesting to me, to maybe have a peace conference. Praxis Peace Institute, which is what I direct now, came out of that peace conference. And as we started looking at the ways we could get to a peaceful culture, we just kept digging. We kept asking more and more questions. And we looked at citizen activism, how that needs to be part of the picture. We looked at the cultural stories that affect how we think, and maybe we can do a cultural intervention and start moving some of those stories in a better direction. And then we got to economics, and that's how we got to Mondragon. Economics has been the one that never ends, because until we really work out both the changes in the culture and the changes in our economic values and the economic structures we create, we're stuck with the kind of world we have right now. And I think that could be extremely dangerous. Just listening to the ad on the radio as we had our break, this corporate prey, I thought, yeah, I want to see that film. And we want to avoid that. And yet we're going at a fast pace toward that. So there are two things we're really focused on at Praxis Peace Institute. One is culture. We have a three-part series starting in March on that. And the other is Mondragon, which is looking at, this is a model that shows us not only how to do business differently, but how to live differently. It's a whole picture. It's holistic. And so when I found that, and I found that in the mid-90s, I was actually working for or volunteering for Jerry Brown at that time and choosing guests for his radio show. And one of them was Terry Molnar, who talked about Mondragon. And after that show, I called him up and I said, you've got to tell me everything you know about Mondragon. It sounds incredible. And that was the beginning. It wasn't until maybe 13 years later that I actually made contact with people at Mondragon and have been going there ever since and bringing groups there pretty much every year to study their model and to tour the region and see how life is there. It's very, very inspiring.
You know, part of what you're really suggesting is that really it's all one conversation. If you're talking about how do we avoid war, then there's all sorts of other ways that people apply aggression and exploitation that doesn't look like outright shooting people. And right. Obviously, to have a different sensibility about what's important in life, that what's important is to for the people in that region, obviously, is that sense of community and connection that there isn't a huge gap. I mean, obviously a 6-to-1 gap of pay grade, you know, I mean, some people make 6 times what other people make. And that really is a, you know, it's an indication of meritocracy and the value of that work. But to have people make 20, 30, and 40 times what other people make, it creates the exact problem that you're talking about. And you kind of hinted at it earlier that the overclass and the underclass kind of are codependent, that in a certain way we have the problems that we have because we have these, you know, these two forces at one at either end of society. My jokey way of saying is that the middle class is caught between the lowly criminal and the highly criminal, you know, and the highly criminal being at the top, you know.
Well put.
So anyway, so let's I thank you for that background, and I think that people are really going to understand how economics and the spiritual sensibilities of how we relate to one another as a way of giving us a true alternative to war that arises from how things occur naturally. Let's talk more about the history of Mondragon and what those factors were that allowed it to develop under the radar.
Well, I think a lot of that has to be credited to Father Arizmendi Arrieta, because he was really the visionary behind it and the primary educator at the beginning. And I think when he started the bank, which was a brilliant idea, and that helped grow the businesses and create more jobs and more businesses. And primarily what they did in the early years were industrial. They had industrial appliances and domestic appliances that they made. When we first went there, they were making washing machines and refrigerators, and we toured those factories and saw the whole quality control and how they did everything, which was very commendable at the time. There were, you know, those kind of repetitive jobs, and they didn't let anyone stay at one station with a repetitive job longer than 2 hours. They had to move and do something else, so that they were always looking at how to protect the worker owner, that they didn't get carpal tunnel, that they didn't, you know, get any physical problems because of their work. And there was a big blackboard in the on the floor that where people, the worker owners, could put their suggestions to the management of things that they could change for the better. And they paid attention to that. You know, it was it's like they're all working together for the same purpose. They're not competing against each other. So it's it was a much better workplace scenario, where it wasn't frantic and it wasn't competitive. It was supportive. And I think one of the there's so many ways I could go from here right now. I'm going to let you go to the next question instead of go on to something else.
Okay. Well, actually, you kind of suggested something, and that is back in the day, I used to teach auto workers at UAW auto workers at Wayne State University. And one of their great frustrations is nobody ever listened to their suggestions, number one. Mm. And so consequently, it created an adversarial situation where people are operating at cross purposes. The foremen are speeding up the line, subtly speeding up the line to get things to happen quicker rather than being concerned about repetitive motion or anything like that. You know, and again, it's an adversarial thing. The union, you know, is against the management, stands up against for the workers. And what you're describing is a situation where here's a community of people, and some happen to have this role, and some happen to have that role. They like to shift the roles around a lot. Related to that, what happens when I'm sure that a business can't be 100% successful. Probably some of these ventures have failed. What happens then? What happens to the workers who are part of that venture?
This is very interesting because there's a case to study at this point, and there wasn't when we first went to Mondragon. Most of their businesses, I think it was less than 1%, had failed over this long period of time. But what happened in 2013 is their largest business failed. Fagor Domestic Appliances. They still have Fagor industrial appliances, which are extraordinary. And we saw them at their Culinary Arts Center in San Sebastian. It's completely outfitted by all the appliances made by Fagor Industrial. But Fagor Domestic Appliances bankrupted a few years ago. And I think, you know, there are lots of reasons why that happened. And one certainly was they probably held on to the business longer than was practical just because it was the first one that ever existed in the Mondragon Cooperative. There was a lot of emotional feeling for it. Plus, it employed about 2,400 people. So letting that go meant all of a sudden 2,400 people would be out of work. So what they did, one of their core, they have 10 core principles, and one of them is it's the interconnectedness, it's intercooperation among the different cooperatives. So what they did when that happened, of course, they also, which I didn't mention before, have their own social insurance company that does the pensions, does unemployment, is able to pay when those or sick leave, things like that. So they have all that within their system as well, and medical insurance, in addition to Spain's. So they're kind of well taken care of. But when Fagor went bankrupt and these people were all of a sudden out of a job, intercooperation really kicked in. Within 2 years, what they had done, they did three different things. They let a certain number of people take early retirement and still getting the benefits they would normally get, but they could leave work early so there'd be places for other people to step into jobs at other companies. And the other was they started looking for other companies that could take some of the workers to give them jobs in other businesses that were part of the Mondragon Cooperative. Since there are over 100 of them, they were able to place a lot of people. And during the time that they were looking, I mean, it took up to 2 years to place most of them, some earlier, some later, is that they were on 80% of their salary from the unemployment insurance while they were waiting to get placed in a new job. So they weren't all of a sudden out in the street with no money. They were still getting paid. And so that's part of the security of the whole Mondragon cooperatives. It's incredible. I mean, it's on every level. There's protection, there's support. So it's quite profound. And there were others that wanted to do training for other kinds of positions. And they thought they took this opportunity. Mondragon provided free training for management, for being board members, for other jobs. So they took advantage of that and then maybe changed positions eventually. So by the time we went there in 2017, I think pretty much everybody had either been replaced, retired early, or found new work within the system, which is quite profound, actually.
It's very profound. Their, yeah.
I mean, yeah. It's a lot of people. It's not like 100 people. It's 2,400 people.
You know,
live by their values.
One of the distortions, when people think of socialism, they always think of state socialism. And here is a situation where people voluntarily created an entity that's not a government entity that has to, given the evidence that one company went bankrupt, has to compete in the marketplace. And the remarkable thing is that so few of these businesses have failed and so many have been able to succeed. Keeping this other value of the human being, of supporting community, of making sure everybody has a chance to thrive. And it's not something that's imposed top down by some regime. It's simply something that the people have voluntarily agreed. And as you said earlier, it may not be for everybody.
Right. Well, one of the reasons why they're able to continue and not their businesses don't fail, I think part of it is their ethic and the way they work together cooperatively. And the other is, and this is a business thing, they have the largest research and development complex in all of Europe. They have 15 separate research and development entities. Nowhere in Europe is anything this big in R&D. So they have put a lot of energy, time, money, training into developing new ideas, from computer chips to actually they make auto parts. I think it's brake pads. They make all kinds of things that are sold all over the world. And, you know, you're not going to see Mondragon on your tire rim or whatever, but they are selling parts like that to most of the car manufacturers in the U.S. as well as Europe. So they're doing all kinds of businesses that they're always looking to improve what they're doing. They're always at the cutting edge. And because of that, that quest, which is a business quest, it's not just a personal quest or a social quest, they put it all together in a way that makes it thrive, really.
It's astounding because, again, it's, you hear so many arguments about, well, you know, if you try to take care of everybody, you're not going to be able to make it. Obviously, they have been able to make it. Obviously, they have been able to thrive. And it sounds like, you know, given, you know, when I taught auto workers, I mean, talk about repetitive motion. You go into a factory and there's noise. You do the same job day in and day out, and you live for the day that you retire. And, you know, I'm sure it's a much longer conversation about how businesses and workers developed in the isolation of the United States as opposed to Europe, where there's been a lot more of this community. When we were in Europe, when we went to your conference in Dubrovnik years ago, we were in Germany, we were in Italy, we were in France, and in Vienna. And what we noticed was mostly everybody from fairly rich to not rich, they all rode public transportation. And probably there was a 1% who had their limousines and who didn't relate to the normal people. But the upper middle class and so on, people all identified with one another as part of a community. And I think we're seeing how this has frayed so much in our country. When we get back from the next break, we're going to have a more of a conversation about how this can be applied here in the United States. So stay tuned. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network. Presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
I rescued Toast from my shelter in 2011. I love Toast because she's a lazy diva. Toast does whatever she wants, obviously. She's sleeping right now. She's so loving. She's so comforting. When I walked into the shelter, I knew right then that she was special.
Toast, Instagram star and shelter pet. Amazing adoption stories start in shelters. Start yours today. Visit theshelterpetproject.org to find a pet near you. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Hi, Steve Behrman back here with my guest, Georgia Kelly. We're talking about the Mondragon Cooperatives. And this segment, I want to really talk about how the lessons learned and things that have been done there can be translated, or as a matter of fact, are being translated here in the United States.
Okay, and before we do that, I would just like to tell people who are listening about our website, which is www.praxispeace.org, where there's information on our trips to Mondragon and other programs that we have, including Richard Wolff in February and our culture series. So, and I want to mention that again at the end and spell it out, but to see how we would do this in the U.S. or how it is being done, because I live in the Bay Area and there are several worker-owned businesses in this region. And one that comes closest in some ways to the intercooperation model that Mondragon has are the Arizmendi bakeries, which are, there's six of them located within the Bay Area. And they do support each other in a way that's similar. They had one experience like that with a new bakery they opened a few years back that needed help from some of the other bakeries, which they were able to do and kept that bakery alive. So it's interesting that, that they're the first ones that I know that have actually used that kind of a model, but they're the, you know, one that has several different businesses connected together.
They even took the name of the priest, didn't they? They even took
the name of the priest. The priest, Arizmendi.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And some of their worker owners have been on our trip. We did have two scholarships every year, and we're trying to get the funding to have more scholarships again, because it really helped create more knowledge about this model in the U.S., and especially for people working in cooperatives here. Another one that's very interesting is in Sonoma County, where I live, is in Petaluma, and it's Alvarado Street Bakery, and I think they have about 110 worker owners. And their model is very similar to the Mondragon model. I think the last I heard, the CEO, his salary was three times what the average worker owner was there. So it's still this very equitable model. And they earn a very good living wage. So people are happy there. And they're worker owners. And I visited the business a few times. And very impressed with how it's run and how happy the people seem to be with what their jobs are there. Again, it's similar to Mondragon in, one of the things that we were hearing the first year we went, our leader kept saying, talking about security in the workplace and security. And we were in the factory at that time of the Fogler factory. And I thought, well, I don't see any security people around here. What is he talking about? And I said, I think when you're talking about security, you mean something different than we think of when we hear that word. And he said, well, I mean worker safety. We're looking for the guard. We're looking for the security guard, and he's talking about worker safety, which was a whole different thing. And he did have to explain what he meant to everybody, because nobody was getting what he was talking about. So, that's the thing that people listen to each other. That's the same that's true here. I think what people have learned who have gone to Mondragon on our trip, because we've actually developed a really good trip over the years, where we learn a lot of different things. We go to some of the businesses. We have some of their leading people, CEOs, retired CEOs from businesses lecturing to us. We go to the bank, the culinary arts, which is part of their university system. They have three universities, and we do spend a day at one of their universities. And we also go to their parliament. So we have a special session with the Department of Peace and Human Rights there. We're the only group that has that. And part of it is our focus on peace, too. So I think this is the way people get the idea of a whole culture, and they can bring that back to starting a cooperative here or cooperatives they're already involved in. There are several in the New York area, Brooklyn. I can't name them all right now, but there are enough of them in this country that I think people can get a sense of, yes, it's doable here. We can learn from Mondragon, because they're still the pinnacle of this model. But we find that they're working here. There's Rainbow Grocery in San Francisco, which has been going since the 70s, worker-owned, and Alvarado Street Bakery that I mentioned to you has been going since the 70s, and they sell bread wholesale all over the U.S. So it's a big company in that sense, and it's been working very well all these years. So it's
obviously.
Here.
Yeah, it still exists. Yeah, and of course, I think that mostly people don't know about these things.
They don't.
What do you think? What are your ideas or what are your insights about how to accelerate, amplify this this kind of vibration and accelerate people starting these sort of businesses?
Well, I think there are a lot of younger people and millennials who are interested in cooperatives. At least that's what I've seen in the trips that we've done and also in talking to people in this field here. A lot of people are interested in it. I think it would be especially usable or effective in agriculture, small farms, organic agriculture. It would be perfect because nobody nowadays wants to work in a field all the time. But if you have a cooperative, you can work it out in a way that everybody has some free time, and yet it works well. I think agriculture is a perfect place for a cooperative. Now, it's something that Mondragon has not done that much of. They only have four agricultural cooperatives, and we've never visited any of them. So I think this is something, though, in this country, especially in California, this could be a really good place for people to come together and create a cooperative. And I think there's something like this happening in Oregon, and I know this could also happen in California. We're ripe for that kind of cooperative here.
Now, hasn't there been a change recently, last year, some change in the laws governing cooperatives in California that allow some kind of limited form of, I would call it investment? Do you know more? Know anything about that?
Right. A little bit. I did know more, and I've forgotten some of it. But one of the young lawyers who came to our seminar in 2012, he actually helped write that legislation that was passed by the California State Assembly and Senate and signed by Governor Jerry Brown, which does help cooperatives when they're starting up to raise investor cash rather than have their own, you know, because they don't usually have enough money. So they're able to do that. How they work it out, because the investors aren't going to be worker owners, I'm not sure how that all works out. But at least now they can get startup capital where they weren't able to do that before. So that was a very significant change in cooperative law in California.
Yeah, I know that certain cooperatives have what they call P shares, where, you know, they may not be ownership, but they get a share for participating, and when that's paid off, then that relationship is complete. So it's a way for people to put sweat equity in, even if they're not ultimately an owner, and they can get the benefit of that, and, you know, cash out when the cash comes in.
Right. And that
I agree with you about agriculture. Yeah.
Yeah, it just seems like a natural to me, because we are going to need a lot of small farms that are organic, that aren't genetically engineered foods, that aren't polluted with artificial fertilizers. We're going to need a lot of it, and we don't have enough of it right now. So I think it's a place that is begging for cooperatives.
You know, as you'll find out, my wife Trudy has been very, very, very interested in agricultural and industrial hemp, and using that, the hempcrete building materials, and so on. And one of her ideas is that it's a natural, because, again, as you say, there's such a variety of different tasks that it's a natural for a worker-owned co-op. And as you were saying, young people who've got the energy to do many, many different kinds of things, and they love the variety and so on, switching from one thing to another. So I think that there may be some area there in as you say, in small agriculture, where this can replace the system that we have now, where we bring in all of these laborers, and then we
right.
either arrest them or send them home, you know. So this is it's much more organic and hardly pay them. So this is by the way, thankless task. By the way, so
and they get paid from the pesticides and fertilizers and God knows what all.
You know, it really, I think one of the things that comes very clear when you notice the contrast is the heartfulness, and I don't want to use the word heartlessness, but I will use the word heartlessness, of the way businesses in this country are expected to be. You know, it's like, what's the matter? There's a bottom line. That's all you need to do is preserve that profit for your shareholders and externalize all the other costs out there. And then you wonder, you know, when it's time to pay for those, why we are so in debt as a society, you know? It just
seems like endless growth hamster wheel that we've got to get off. And that's where I feel, because it's going to destroy the planet and life on the planet. That's where I feel we need to look at culture and the influences of culture, because it's an important part of how we're all brainwashed by the culture and by the ideas, by the films we see, the TV programs, the social media, how our thinking is manipulated. And we really have to stop and assess how we're being manipulated, because we're on automatic pilot a lot of the time. So to make the kind of changes that Mondragon has made, and I think maybe part of that, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, the Basque were able to do that because they're kind of socialist anyway. Well, it's not so simple to just dismiss them that way, because we have been able to do it on a smaller scale here. And I think the culture probably is different, but they had to go through major changes to go from where they were in the 1940s to where they are today. And it's that kind of a cultural shift that we need, and an economic shift, because the kind of economic priorities in our country are really destroying the planet.
You know, you mentioned earlier that part of your programs that you do at Praxis are designed to shift perspectives around cultural issues. Why don't you talk a little bit about that, and perhaps an upcoming program that would be an example of that?
Okay. We have a program on – well, we have a couple of programs. One, we do have Richard Wolff in February and his wife talking about the connection between power – dominance, wealth, and sexual assault, and how this works together in a society, what we can do about it, which is part of a cultural thing. And then we have a series focused primarily on culture that will be three different events. Two of them will be workshops, and our leader for that is Jeremy Lent, who's written a book called The Patterning Instinct, which is one of the most profound books written in this new century, and I highly recommend
it. What is the book called? Say that again. What's the book called?
The Patterning Instinct.
Ah,
it's kind of a history of how cultures have changed and evolved and influenced each other, and how what our search for meaning, where it's taking us. It's a very, very good book, and so it's based partially on that. And he will start that off, and then I'm also doing part of it with him, and also Elizabeth Ferguson will be from Compassionate Climate will also be involved in this. So that will be in March, April. And then our trip is in May, from May 20th to 26th in Mondragon, Spain. And information from that is on our website, www.praxispeace.org. They can get information on all of those programs is on our website.
You know, I've been involved with Praxis and familiar with it for maybe 14 or 15 years. And what I so appreciate about it is you are a very, very well-read individual, and you also devour books and you contextualize the books.
Yes, I do.
And you also put together study groups and discussion groups around various books. And I know that there's been so many phenomenal programs that you've done, because I've been at that. I've been to one of your conferences in Dubrovnik, one in Sonoma, in the town of Sonoma, where essentially, for all intents and purposes, Sonoma was turned into an Italian village while you were there, and
right.
People could go here and there. It really was. It was quite a charming thing. Are there resources on the –
I want to do that again next year.
It's great. Include me in, huh? But anyway,
absolutely.
So one of the other things is on the Praxis website, is there a way for people to access some of your past programs or anything like that?
Yes, there is. I'm just going to the website myself right now to look where they are. Books and films, videos. There's some videos on the website, and then there are others on YouTube. If you just, I'm not sure where to get them from our site right now. I noticed the other day the link didn't seem to be there. So if you go to YouTube, the ones from our Economics of Sustainability conference are on YouTube, and you can just type in Economics of Sustainability, and all of these different ones will come up. We had some really good speakers at that conference.
You know, Praxis is really, I mean, my experience of it is it's a learning community, and there's a lot of very, very valuable information that can help seed some of these projects like new cooperatives, and also some of the underlying and overriding aspects of our belief systems and things that are unconscious. Georgia, it's been a pleasure having you on Wiki Politiki. We could go on for another hour. We might do that some other time. Georgia Kelly, Praxis Peace Institute, and talking about the Mondragon Cooperatives, and praxispeace.com.
Praxispeace.org.
.org. Praxispeace.org. Okay. Okay, very good. And thank you, Georgia, for being our guest, and we'll catch you next time on Wiki Politiki. Steve Behrman.
Thank you.
Goodbye.